From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour focuses on the Republican wave election of last night. We saw a Republican wave across the country and in New York State. Some surprising results. In fact, we're going to open the hour with a look at what is, I think the consensus is, the most surprising result. And that is the too close to call election result between longtime member of Congress Louise Slaughter, Democrat in the 25th Congressional District, who was taking on Gatestown Supervisor, the Republican Mark Acini. We're going to get an update on where the numbers stand as they count absentee ballots and what we think might be the process going forward here, because there's a lot of urgency to try to get things done as best we can here. So let me turn now the conversation to David Riley. He is a Democrat and Chronicle reporter, and he has been covering this issue really more closely than anybody. He's on the line with us now. David, how are you?
I'm well, Evan. A little sleep-deprived, but otherwise...
I would think many of us were. This was not the race that everybody thought would be the closest, was
it? Yeah, it certainly wasn't. Tim Nealon from Nazareth College, he's a political science professor there, told me last night it was the surprise of the night, if not the decade.
And here we are now. The latest numbers I saw, and I'm sure you're about to confirm or at least correct this. I saw at 11:20 a.m., about 50 minutes ago, Louise Slaughter with 94,251 votes, Mark Acini, 93,646, the margin 605. Is that the latest number, or are there even more updated results?
Yeah, as far as I know, that's the most up-to-date number, and that includes the results from the polls and some of the absentee ballots from Monroe County that were counted last night. But the issue is that there are about 2,800 absentee ballots that were impounded last night in the 55th Senate District. That's where Ted O'Brien and Rich Funke were running against each other. And those have yet to be counted, and we're sort of waiting to hear what's going to happen with that today. There may be a number of other absentee ballots that still need to be counted, I'm hearing now.
Okay, so we're looking at 2,800 absentee ballots, barring any others that we don't yet know about. Mark Acini would have to close the gap of 605. My basic math tells me he would have to pick up roughly 1,703. Wow, look at that quick math, of the 2,800. So not out of the question, especially because those ballots are in the 55th Senate District, which happened to be the one in which Rich Funke cruised to victory over Ted O'Brien. So I guess the bottom line is we really do need to wait. We can't simply project yet, can we, David?
No, we certainly can't. And Acini did allude to that fact last night that these ballots are from a district that went for another Republican candidate last night, and certainly turnout seemed to favor Republicans in this area last night. Turnout in the city, which tends to lean Democratic, was really quite low and quite a bit better out in the suburbs.
When it comes to turnout in this election, look, 2 years ago was a presidential year, so there was 314,000 votes cast in this district. This year, not a presidential year, but only, and again, a quick math is about 188,000. So a massive drop in the actual participation in this election. We also just didn't see it as a high-profile race from where it was 2 years ago. We had Maggie Brooks, the Monroe County executive. David, is that... does that perhaps play to the favor of someone like Mark Acini?
Well, the race with Brooks was really a very different one. It was much harder fought, from my understanding of it. It was also a year with a presidential ticket at the top of the ballot, which always brings out a lot more voters. This is a midterm. It's typical for turnout to be quite a bit lower, and you know, from what I've heard from folks in political circles, that doesn't always favor Democratic voters, and certainly turnout was lower in those areas. So it certainly appears to be a year that favors Republicans.
Talking to David Riley, reporter with the Democrat and Chronicle, who is closely following the counting of the ballots in the Acini Slaughter race. Everyone's asking this midday, David, the timeline here, and we've touched on that briefly, but what's our best guess on the hour by hour, or I don't... people don't want to say day by day or week by week, but where are we in terms of the timeline?
It's sort of anybody's guess. There was supposed to be a court appearance today to lift the impoundment. That was canceled because it sounds like O'Brien's campaign has decided it doesn't want to move forward with that process. So we're sort of waiting to hear from Board of Elections what the next step is in counting those absentees. I haven't been able to get in touch with them yet. Then it will sort of depend on how involved each campaign is and whether they're raising concerns or problems with some of the ballots and sort of what the margin is between the two camps. It really depends on what those absentee ballots ballots say, and when we're able to count them.
The good news is, with 2,800, give or take a few, David, you know, you and I, it's not that many, you and I could probably get them counted today if they would let us. So you know, but I guess it could come down to sort of lawyers. I had a couple of texts from both sides saying that this will be up to the lawyers today. And, you know, I certainly understand the desire to make sure everything is done above board here. But it doesn't sound like Mr. Assini or Ms. Slaughter are concerned yet. This isn't a case where we're hearing allegations of any impropriety, are we?
No, certainly not. But that said, when you've got a margin that's this close and where Assini's got, you know, 600 or so votes to make up, you know, you can surely bet that both sides are going to be looking to count every single ballot and raise any questions that they've got with anything that looks troublesome to them. So I would expect you'll see them.
The latest count, again, Louis Slaughter, 94,251. Mark Assini, 93,646. The difference is 605 votes. That's as of about an hour ago. And if there are roughly 2,800 absentee ballots left to count, Mark Assini, to win by one scant vote, would need to get 1,703 of those 2,800. David Riley, we'll be following your work on the Democrat and Chronicle on democratandchronicle.com. And who knows, we may be seeing something before the end of this program today. So thanks for taking the time, and I suspect we'll talk to you shortly.
Sure. Thanks very much, Evan.
David Riley doing great work for the Democrat and Chronicle as we follow that race. Let me turn now to our colleague and our Albany Bureau correspondent, Karen DeWitt, who's on the line with us now. Before we even talk about the state, Karen, you may spend most of your time in Albany, but I imagine that the Slaughter and Assini race has people buzzing. Are you there, Karen? I'm sorry. Karen, are you there? I am not hearing Karen. Let me see here. I'm going to dump out of that call. Oh, see, I think what happened was we lost David. Are you there, Karen? No? We've lost both of our folks on the line, but that's all right. Let's go ahead and reestablish with Karen DeWitt. And if you want to join the program or comment, we've already had some questions about turnout. We'll try to get those numbers updated for you as well as we look at the various issues impacted. As we go throughout the 2 hours today, we're going to be talking in our second hour to David K. Johnston. He's going to be in studio, investigative journalist and Pulitzer Prize winner. He's going to be talking about a number of issues he's been writing about recently, income disparity, the wage gap, et cetera, but also with an eye on how the results in New York State and across the country last night could impact policy when it comes to minimum wage, wage disparity, et cetera. And we also are going to talk about the way last night's results will impact a number of other issues in New York State. Campaign finance reform, the women's equality agenda, the Buffalo Billion. Will there be a Rochester Billion? Why wasn't there a youth vote? What about the SAFE Act? What was the impact there? And does Mark Assini's campaign last night indicate that negative ads don't work? All of those issues this hour and certainly more that we're going to be working on there. So let me bring in Karen DeWitt, our Albany Bureau correspondent. Karen, how are you?
I'm great.
Well rested, I'm sure.
Oh, yeah. Well, not that, but, you know.
Is everybody buzzing in Albany about the Slaughter Assini race? I mean, that's such a huge story here, and I have to imagine that that's a shock even for those who don't live in this district.
It's actually just filtering through now. I didn't even hear about it till this morning and was really pretty surprised because, I mean, that just seemed like a safe seat, and she's just kind of a fixture in New York politics. So, yeah, that comes as a major surprise. But, you know, given what happened nationally, I guess it shouldn't be so much of a shock, huh?
Well, it was certainly a wave year. It turned into a New York State wave as well. Looking at the state Senate, are Republicans satisfied? They have to be satisfied. But reset it for our listeners now, Karen. Where does the state Senate stand, and what does that mean going forward?
Well, it looks like they do have the 32 votes so that they could rule as a majority without needing to make any deals with other factions like they did for the past 2 years with the so-called Independent Democratic Conference. They can rule outright. They do have one member who is under indictment, Deputy Majority Leader Tom Libous, and if you're convicted of a felony, you have to leave the Senate. We've seen that happen in the past. So it could be, you know, by a one-seat majority is pretty shaky. So the question is, are they going to ally with anybody else? But they don't have to right now. And, yeah, they're pretty happy. Honestly, they've been pretty happy for weeks. I could sense that they were confident. And I was told off the record before that that their internal polls showed they were going to do well. So, yeah, despite the changing demographics in New York State, they're holding on for another 2 years.
All right. So Republicans have outright control of the Senate, at least to start 2015. And for a big issue in this campaign, which was the women's equality agenda, does this mean that the dynamics will have to change, Karen? And by that I mean there are 10 points in the women's equality agenda. Both major parties agree essentially on 9 of them, and the codification of abortion rights is what has stalled all of it. And now that the state Senate will be firmly controlled by Republicans, it looks like either more gridlock on all 10 points or both parties agree to disagree on the 10th point and pass the other 9. Are you getting an indication where this is going next?
Yeah, you know, I agree. It does seem like we're set up for gridlock, especially since Governor Cuomo very strongly in his speech last night said that he was going to push for that abortion rights provision. In fact, he promised it was going to happen, along with raising the minimum wage, public campaign financing, and the DREAM Act, which is college aid for children of immigrants who are in this country illegally. I don't really see how any of these things are going to happen, because Cuomo also on Monday, perhaps setting this whole thing up, says that the Senate Republicans are being pressured by the Conservative Party. And after they helped him on the gay marriage vote and gun control, they haven't wanted to do any of these items because the Conservative Party, you know, has made it clear that they will be punished at the polls. And we did see the final senator who did provide the votes for gay marriage, Mark Grisanti of Buffalo, lost last night. So, you know, given all that, I don't see what their incentive is to do any of these items, at least not in the next couple of years.
It was a bit of a strange victory speech for the governor for that reason, Karen, that you had. He ticked off, I say not ticked off as an offended, I mean he was ticking down the list of some of those progressive priorities, and it just doesn't look within reach now. But at the same time, behind closed doors, the governor has worked and sort of happily with this hybrid coalition, that he hasn't been all that anxious to see his own party controlling all of the branches of the legislature. And so starting in January, what will be the most interesting part for you when we hear the state of the state, the governor's budget? What will you be looking for most, Karen?
Well, I guess I'll be looking for to see what the governor is going to do that's new, other than the items he mentioned that probably aren't going to get passed. But you mentioned him working with the Republicans, fiscal. He's a social progressive, but he's also fiscally conservative, and the Republicans have helped them hold the line on spending and taxes, which I don't think a Democratic Senate would have done. They would have wanted to spend more money. They would have wanted to raise taxes on the wealthy. So I think if they want to find common ground, they will have to focus on the economy. That is Cuomo and the Republican Senate. Dean Skelos already said he wants to focus more on taxes. Cuomo says he wants to cut property tax further. They want to focus on job creation. So they would have to stick to fiscal and economic issues if they want to find common ground. But this governor is ambitious, and as I said, he does like to be seen as a social progressive. So will he get together with the left of his party, who he's not getting along with very well right now, and somehow try to push some of these senators, saying, look, the writing's on the wall, you might as well vote for these things, because your district is not that conservative, and you'll get voted out of office eventually if you don't go along with these things? Or what is the strategy? I'm sure he'll come up with something creative, though, given the way this governor has operated so far.
We're talking to Karen DeWitt. Later this hour, we're going to have Holly Hawkins, the Green Party candidate for governor, on the program. He had just about 5% of the vote in the gubernatorial election this year. And for our listeners, if you want to join the program at any time with our many guests this hour, you can call 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255. It's toll-free, or 263-WXXI, 263-9994. Karen, when you look at the third-party affiliations in this gubernatorial election, you had the Greens. You know, I don't know that Howie Hawkins will tell you that he's thrilled with 5% when he was hoping to get to 10. We'll see what he says later this hour. But that's still 173,000 votes. You had the Women's Equality Party, which was this new creation, and you had the Working Families Party trying to get to 50,000 votes just to make sure they keep a ballot line. Where did things shake out?
Yeah, well, I think it was kind of confusing because you didn't have just the Democratic Party and the Green Party. You had the Working Families Party, who endorsed Cuomo but ended up being unhappy with him and were urging their members, please, even though you don't like Cuomo, vote for our party so we can stay in the ballot. Then you had the Women's Equality Party, as the Working Families Party calls it, the fake party that Cuomo created, and it doesn't really have a structure or a platform or anything like that, but the governor wanted to get more women to vote for him and maybe also to stick it to the Working Families Party, and that's why that one existed. So it was a little muddy, I think, if you were, you know, one of those political types, politically astute types that was trying to strategize when you went to the ballot box as to how you would vote. So I think maybe the vote on the left was sort of split between Working Families and the Green Party. And perhaps, you know, that's why the Greens didn't do as well as they'd hoped.
But the Greens got certainly enough votes to hang in there on future ballots. Working Families cleared that mark. Women's Equality just barely. So it's going to continue to be somewhat muddy on ballots in the future.
Yeah. I'll tell you, though, there's just one.
Go ahead, Karen. We lost Karen again. At least I have. Not sure if Karen can hear me. But once again, I have lost Karen DeWitt. Raj, I don't know if you're hearing. I've lost Karen, so. Okay. Well, let's do this. Let's go ahead and try to get a. Let's see if we can. We're going to be kind of going to multiple guests this hour, and perhaps our technology is sort of inhibiting some of that. But we're going to see if we can get Karen back. Karen, are you there? Yeah, I'm not hearing Karen. We've lost Karen. Let me do this. Let me see if I can turn the conversation for at least for a moment to a man who's waiting to talk to us, and that's Brian Sampson. Brian, are you there? I don't have Brian. Do we have Brian? No? We don't have Brian. Okay, maybe we should probably take a break. Should we do that? Raj, you want to take a break? Let's go ahead. Let's take a short break. We'll get things all set because we have a lot of guests to get to and your phone calls as well. So stay with us on this a day after Election Day edition of Connections. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson, and we're talking about election 2014 on a number of issues, and we just have a long list of guests today, so thank you for bearing with us as we sort of sort through who's on the line and who's not. I think we've got Brian Sampson now. Is that Brian? Are you there? I don't. Now I don't have Brian. Do we have Karen? We don't. We don't have Karen either. Okay, well. Let's go ahead and just kind of run down for you if you missed some of what happened last night. We're still waiting, as we heard from David Riley of the Democrat and Chronicle earlier this hour, still working on trying to find out what's going to happen next in the Louis Slaughter-Mark Cassini race. And David Riley with the Democrat and Chronicle reporting that we could see those results come within hours, but there's not a guarantee. They're still waiting to count 2,800 absentee ballots, all from the 55th Senatorial District in New York State. And by the way, that means a district that went very heavily Republican yesterday. That's why Mark Cassini is hoping that he can close the gap. The gap is 605 votes. So he'll need roughly 1,700 votes of the 2,800 votes that are outstanding if he wants to overtake Louis Slaughter. We're waiting to see that. If those results happen during this program at any time today, we will certainly let you know about that. Let me bring in Brian Sampson now. Brian, how are you?
I'm great, Evan. How are you?
Good. Thanks for your patience. Sir, he's the former executive director of Unshackle Upstate, who has changed seats now, Brian, but your expertise on a number of issues is welcome here. First of all, let our listeners know where you are now.
I had the fortune to become president of the Associated Builders and Contractors of New York State.
Okay, but fresh off your term with Unshackle Upstate, and you were, and your organization, and Unshackle, very outspoken when it comes to campaign finance reform, put out a white paper about it, talked about some of your concerns about it. Last night, we saw a red wave in this state, and now, what's the result that you expect going forward for campaign finance reform on the state level?
Well, I would certainly hope that it's a dead issue. I mean, when you look at what the voters took to heart last night, it is about job creation. It's about having a government that's affordable, and using their tax dollars to pay for political campaigns is not something that they're going to support. So I would hope that this is a lesson learned by everybody that won last night, and that this would be an issue that doesn't move forward.
Okay, and I think a lot of people are expecting now that on the state level, campaign finance reform is dead. And frankly, Brian, despite what the governor said, as Karen DeWitt mentioned earlier this hour, despite what he said at his own victory rally last night, he didn't attack this issue with all that much gusto this year or last year, unless I'm reading it wrong.
No, it's absolutely correct, because here's what the governor knows, and what I hope your listeners will understand as well. No amount of taxpayer finance campaign money would have offset the amount of special interest money that comes into these races. So when you see all of that money that comes in because of things like the McCutcheon decision, you know, with the Supreme Court, what that means is anybody can spend in that race. You use taxpayer dollars to try to fund those campaigns, it's going to do nothing to influence that outside money. So you're effectively wasting vital taxpayer resources to stuff mailboxes with mailers and robocalls to homes and, you know, the polling that we all got throughout this campaign. So I think the governor realizes it's a lost leader. He can talk about it, but it's not something that the taxpayers support.
And Brian, doesn't that, though, ignore the idea that some people have, which says if we go to a public financing or campaign finance reform in some regard, that the rules would have to change for other interests, for outside interests as well? And couldn't we walk and chew gum at the same time? Couldn't that change be enacted alongside campaign finance reform?
Well, you could, but unfortunately you have the decision of the Supreme Court that would effectively overrule that. And any of the other finance programs that we've looked at and have been discussed, like the vaunted one out of New York City, which, by the way, has led to more corruption cases of campaign finance laws there than really anywhere else in the country. When you look at all of that stuff, there's nothing that's been proposed that would clip the wings of outside special interests, whether that be big financial donors, the public employee unions, you know, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, whatever that may be. They still have the ability to spend in these races.
Talking to Brian Sampson, the former executive director of Unshackle Upstate. Either way, based on the results last night, would you be surprised if New York State did anything with campaign finance reform in 2015 or even 2016?
I would be shocked. Yeah. There's no appetite for it.
Well, there's. I think the one part of that comment that may be challengeable is when voters are polled on if they're concerned about the influence of money in politics. Depending on how the questions are asked, voters often will tell you that they are concerned that money is too influential in politics. So doesn't that mean that there's room for some reform on some level, whether even if it's not a New York City style 6-to-1 matching or however you want to structure it, isn't there room for some kind of reform?
Asking a person if they're concerned about money in politics, you are overwhelmingly going to get a yes response. Asking them if they support a system that will use their taxpayers to pay for political campaigns results in an overwhelming no. Yes, people understand that there is money in politics and that sometimes that money can lead to influence, but there's been no system that's been created that makes it a fair and level playing field. You know, the good government groups want to tell you that it leads to less corruption. It doesn't lead to less corruption. We are always going to elect people that will try to manipulate the laws. So when you boil it all down, it comes up as a waste of vital resources that could be used to improve our infrastructure, to make education better, to look at some of those issues that, you know, we talked about during this campaign season that are very important to taxpayers.
Brian, we had you on this program recently to talk about the scaffold law, which, again, if it seems esoteric to our listeners, it's still very important to both unions and businesses. There is a Morelli-Gallivan bill out there that would, we could see some reform for scaffolding, for scaffold laws, and unions have said that this would be take away some of their protections. I know the, a lot of business leaders, yourself included, have disagreed based on the results last night. I don't want to debate what we should do with scaffold or WICs or others,
sure,
but just based on the results last night, do you expect in 2015 changes to scaffold, WICs, or others?
Yes. When you look at some of the issues that came up last night, whether that be improvement in our public infrastructure, making schools better for our kids, all of those things cost money. The scaffold law adds to the cost of construction for public projects. It needs to be fixed. It needs to get resolved. It will take those dollars that we have and make them go further, which is ultimately what government should be doing, is finding the best way to invest the tax dollars that they collect.
And Brian, last question, and we'll let you go. As the former executive director of Unshackle Upstate, there was a lot of question about whether this governor and this government would be in favor of fracking. We're past the election now. The governor's indicated that we're not that far away from more clarity on that issue. Do you expect 2015 to bring more clarity on fracking?
I think we'll see it before the year is out. The governor has said very clearly he will address fracking before the end of his first term. That term is up December 31st. I think what we're going to see is the state move forward with a pilot program in the five counties of the southern tier. They'll drill somewhere between 20 and 50 wells, demonstrate that you can do it safely, you can do it economically, and you can do it in an environmentally friendly way, and then New York will have the opportunity to produce its own natural gas.
Brian Sampson, formerly of Unshackle Upstate, and now, again, the new position is what, Brian?
President of the Associated Builders and Contractors of the Empire State.
And I know you're not that far away, and we'll see you on this program in the future. We appreciate your time today.
Always appreciate it, Evan. Thanks.
All right, that's Brian Sampson. Let's do this. For our listeners who want to join the program, again, we've got multiple guests lined up here. So Paul in Rochester, we're going to be coming to you and some others who want to join the conversation. But I don't want to make the next caller wait any longer, and that's Howie Hawkins, the Green Party candidate for governor who picked up nearly 5% of the vote in the gubernatorial election last night. Howie, thanks for taking the time to join the program again. It's good to talk to you.
Well, thanks for having me on.
173,510 votes for Howie Hawkins on the Green Party line. That's 4.9%. 4 years ago, it was only 59,906, 1.3%. So you nearly quadrupled your total in 4 years. But at the same time, Howie, you indicated you were hoping for double digits. Are you disappointed in the final numbers?
Well, they are what they are. The polls were wrong, but that's not surprising. Very low turnout, so it's really hard for the pollsters to get an accurate sample. 5% is more than an independent party on the left running for governor has got in nearly a century. You have to go back to the socialists in 1918 and 1920. So, you know, it's a historic vote. It gives us some leverage going forward, and all the issues we are campaigning on are coming right up. I just heard you talk about fracking. I think the Unshackled guy is right. Cuomo's going to frack New York. And so now we're going to really push the legislature to pass that bill to ban. And if they don't, we'll be running candidates against those legislators in 2016. And then we got school funding coming up. It's a crisis in cities like Syracuse and Rochester. There's just not adequate funds. We've laid off a quarter of our staff in Syracuse over the last 4 years. We got to get that funding back up for the inner city schools. Single-payer health care. Hearings are coming up later this month. I mean, all the things we've been running on are coming up fast, so we're going to take our vote and get engaged in the legislative process over the next 6 months.
Talking to Howie Hawkins, the Green Party gubernatorial candidate who picked up around 5% of the vote yesterday. On school funding, Howie, here is what I think might be the underreported story so far today, which is that Prop 3 yesterday passed resoundingly, 59-41. That means $2 billion for schools that has to be spent on either technology, security, or pre-K. School communities across this state did not largely come out in strong support of this. Nice it did, but largely schools were concerned, Howie, that if this passed, that the governor would then say in 2015, look, you just got $2 billion more from the state. You can't come back and ask for more. We all have to tighten our belt. Do you expect New York State to look at this and say, hey, Prop 3 just passed. You got $2 billion coming. Don't come and ask for more.
I expect that argument will be used, which is, it's really a bad argument because this is borrowed money. This is not money for the operating budget. Although in practice, that's what it'll be because a lot of this money is going to go for computers and software so more kids can take the high-stakes testing. And that equipment and software will be obsolete in a few years. That should be in an operating budget. You shouldn't borrow for that. The finance charges on this $2 billion is $500 million to $750 million. You know, Wall Street loves it. The vendors for the software and computers and tests love it. But it's not good for our public schools. And I'm afraid you're right. You know, this will be used as an argument to keep our spending low in terms of state aid to education, which is at a 65-year low as a proportion of the state budget. This is not going to help our kids in the schools.
And before I get to the phones, Howie, and I know some people would love to have a chance to talk to you or air some thoughts about what happened yesterday, campaign finance reform, Brian Sampson, formerly of Unshackle Upstate, says it's basically dead now, that you've got a Republican-controlled Senate, the governor doesn't have much appetite for it to begin with, and don't expect anything in 2015. Agree?
Well, we're going to make it an issue. I heard him say it never works, it never levels the playing field. I beg to differ. Up in Maine, they have a full public campaign finance system, not the partial system that passed the Assembly and that Cuomo promotes, where everybody who qualifies gets an equal grant, and then it's a level playing field. And I got Republicans up there who will come down to New York and testify because they love it. They don't have to dial for dollars. They can be legislators. And I can get Democrats down here, too. We're gonna raise that issue and push the full public campaign finance bill, which hasn't got the attention it should have in previous debates.
Okay, fair enough. But we also have people like Mr. Sampson saying, even if you have that public match, 6-1 in New York City or whatever system you want to use, it doesn't change the fact that outside interests can spend, the dark money is going to be there. We all had mailings this election season, Howie, and many times we had mailings that it was hard to tell where they were even coming from. And the contention is, even if you have a public match, it doesn't change that.
Well, that doesn't mean you throw up your hands and give up. To stop the dark money, the independent expenditures, we need a U.S. constitutional amendment. But you can have a public financing system that gives sufficient funds to candidates that opt in that they can get their message out to the voters. And people will know who's running on the clean public money and who's running on dirty money. It won't be perfect, but it'll be a lot better.
On Twitter, Mark says, isn't this just a repudiation of what Democrats and the Green Party have been advocating? Isn't the Republican victory yesterday a repudiation of that? Howie?
Well, most people didn't even know I was on the ballot or what I stood for. We had one debate. That's another thing public campaign financing would do. It would have officially sponsored series of debates. So a governor like Cuomo couldn't hide behind his paid ads, which, by the way, were paid for as much by rich Republicans as rich Democrats. That's well documented. 331 people gave him $22 million for his campaign. That's a handful of the elite, the super rich, deciding who our governor's going to be. And I don't think it's a repudiation. You look at public opinion polls, and people are with a more progressive agenda. The problem of American politics is that progressive values don't translate into progressive public policies because we've got a two-party system where two parties are owned by the 1%. That's what we're trying to challenge. It's like a duopoly and a shared monopoly, and we're the little business trying to get our market share. And the duopoly is doing all these things to prevent us from getting in. But we got our foot in the door this election.
Let me get Paul in Rochester. Thanks for waiting, Paul. Go ahead. You're on Connections here.
Yes. Good afternoon. It's an odd statement, but everybody's sort of surprised at the Louise Slaughter race and her challenger. And as I said, it's an odd statement, but I wonder how much luck went into her challenger's pocket based on her age.
Ask the question again, Paul, if you could.
I said, I wonder how much luck was given to her challenger based on her age, AGE.
You know, it's hard to say, but do you suspect, Paul, that ageism was part of it?
To be truthfully honest, yes, I do. So I've met Louise Slaughter, and she's a grand lady. But a lot of times, age does have a lot to do with things. So I'm just curious if anybody else would have that same question.
Paul, thanks for the call. The answer that I have is that we don't know offhand, and that certainly it's possible that some percentage of the vote in the Assini-Slaughter race was based on that factor. I can tell you that, the best we can tell, Mark Assini did not seek to make that an issue. That he didn't, you know, and that frankly, a lot of the analysis today with why Mark Assini performed so well is that he didn't go negative. That he didn't try to attack Louise Slaughter in any kind of personal way, because his concern was that if you sort of provoke her biggest supporters into coming out in large numbers, that he couldn't possibly win. And he has said that he didn't want to wake a kind of sleeping giant, let them sleep right through the election. And it turns out it's possible that that's what happened. Let me bring back Howie Hawkins into the conversation. Howie, before I wrap with you, what else going forward stands out to you as the message, as you look across New York State and look across the country? It was a big Republican night. What else stands out to you that the lessons that you and that you want voters to take?
Well, they need to look at the grassroots and see what people did when they really had a choice in front of them and knew what their options were. In Richmond, California, the green-led Richmond Progressive Alliance beat back a multi-million-dollar campaign by Chevron, which has refineries in that city, which the Progressive Alliance there has been raised the taxes and reduced pollution on, along with a bunch of other policies. They won yesterday because the voters in Richmond knew exactly what was at stake. There were bans on fracking passed in California, Ohio, and even Denton, Texas, in the heart of oil and gas fracking country in Texas. So that's where people have lived with this industry, and they know it's bad. So, you know, I think our 5% fits in with those, positive signs for the grassroots progressive movement, and we just got to build on those things. So while the Republicans did sweep, as I came back in, you were talking about the lack of turnout. You know, that's the problem. Most people are totally turned off by the politics, all the negative politicking and the lack of responsive government. So they've opted out. I mean, the election for governor is less than 4 million votes. It may be a record low. I don't think we've gone this low ever. So that's a big problem, too. We got to get the voters interested again.
And Howie, Tavis Smiley of PBS said before the election that Democrats and progressives have to stop just assuming that minorities will vote for them or will turn out in large numbers. And Tavis Smiley essentially said that Democrats assume they have the minority vote, and yet when it comes to governing, they don't address issues that impact minorities effectively enough to earn it. What do you think?
I think that's exactly right. I mean, Jesse Jackson was saying that to the Democrats in the 1980s, and they haven't been responsive. I mean, my regret in the debate is Cuomo was pointing the finger at Astorino about him resisting a court order to get rid of some exclusionary zoning, but he has done nothing positive, and we have a civil rights and racial justice platform that would establish a cabinet-level civil rights department to enforce the laws we got, a new public housing program to begin to bring us back together. We're the most segregated state by both race and class in the country. And, these are important issues, and the Democrats, and no more than the Republicans, are addressing them, and that's why, you know, blacks and Latinos are opting out. They're saying none of these people represent us.
All right, Howie, stay there. Let me get Stephen in Rochester. Go ahead, Stephen. Thanks for calling. Go ahead.
Yes, I'd like to make a comment that I personally don't understand the United States general public on yesterday's election, because basically I'm looking at what's been going on. I've been following a lot of what goes on in this country over the years, and basically I see that the economy is improving. For me personally, it's the first time I've had affordable health care where I've gotten to be, you know, we haven't had that in years. And I can't understand why the United States public didn't support Democrats this year. I know I did. I went out and voted for the first time in 14 years for Democrats. And the reason being, I think they've done a good job. And personally, I look at what happened in 2008. The number one cause of basically why we had so many bankruptcies and mortgage delinquent payments that led to that derivative problem we had was people could not afford health care. And a lot of people were running up on their credit cards, bills to pay for that. I also see that the problem with high taxes is the fact that it's international trade deficits, that we do not produce enough of what we consume in this country. And basically, it leads to people being unemployed and the government having to pick up the slack for companies that run around the world in the race to the bottom. So basically, I had to get out and vote this year for Democrats. And despite the fact that they didn't win, I wanted to at least put in a vote to say that I think they did a good job.
Stephen, thanks for the call. Let's let Howie respond. Howie, what do you make of that?
Well, I think a lot of people didn't come out for the Democrats because, under Obama, they bailed out Wall Street and sold out Main Street. I mean, just take the mortgage issue. There was money in there to help people who were underwater, and it wasn't released under the HAMP program. Healthcare, I just know from calling, asking supporters to contribute money, when people get sick, that health insurance doesn't cover them, and they're in deep financial trouble. And we've seen that with Romney Care in Massachusetts, which was the model for Obamacare nationally. So a lot of people still aren't happy with the healthcare system. Energy, it seems like Sarah Palin won the election. Obama adopted the Republican slogan, all of the above energy strategy. So we've expanded new areas of offshore drilling. We're fracking everywhere but New York so far. And Obama's crowing about how we're producing more oil than Saudi Arabia now. These are policies that a lot of people are saying, with Democrats like that, who needs Republicans? And they're staying home.
All right, Howie, let me wrap with this before we turn to another guest. Last question for you, Howie. We had Stephen call in and say he was frustrated with the results. Those on the right tell us they're thrilled with the results in New York and around the country yesterday. Dave on Twitter thinks that there's a narrative that we might be missing. He says Governor Cuomo wants a Republican Senate in this state to blame for not carrying through on progressive promises. Simple as that. So what Dave is saying is, yeah, the governor in his victory speech talked about campaign finance reform and the women's equality agenda, but it's almost impossible to get that through with the construction of the state Senate now, and that he knew that. And now he can just say, well, look, it's the obstructive Republicans, as opposed to being sincere about it. What do you think, Howie?
I think that's exactly right. I've had Democratic state senators tell me that point blank. That we had, Skelos had the veto in the last session and now has it in this session because that's what Cuomo wanted, and he helped set it up. He helped set up the coalition with the Independent Democratic Conference last session. Now the Republicans got an outright majority, and that insulates him from progressive reforms he doesn't want anyway.
Howie Hawkins, the Green Party candidate, picked up 173,000 votes, 5% last night. Thanks for taking the time to follow up with us today, Howie, and I know we'll talk to you again.
Okay, thanks for having me on.
Howie Hawkins, Green Party candidate. Let's turn the conversation now back to the state assembly. One of the highest profile races locally was in the 134th Assembly District. It was an open seat after Bill Reilich went to become Greasetown supervisor. Two retired members of law enforcement were going after that seat, and it was a resounding victory for former U.S. Marshal Peter Lawrence, who's on with us now. Peter, congratulations on your victory.
Thank you, Walter. I appreciate it.
Well, and we've talked to you on this program before, Peter, but let me also say it again right here. I know you have said enthusiasm about the SAFE Act, or I would say opprobrium for the SAFE Act, motivated a lot of people. Your victory over Gary Putup in a pretty big number, how much do you attribute that to the SAFE Act? Hold on 1 second, Peter. I've lost Peter. Okay, so we had Peter. We've lost him. Peter, if you're hearing me, do me a favor and call us back if you could, and we'll try to finish the hour with a conversation with Peter Lawrence. Again, he won in the 134th Assembly District, picked up that seat over Gary Putup, almost a 2-to-1 margin there from what we're seeing in the results. Two retired members of law enforcement, both spent about 30 years in law enforcement. Peter, finishing his career after an appointment from George W. Bush to the U.S. Marshal's Office and spent nearly 8 years as a U.S. Marshal before deciding to get back into public life this year and run for the state assembly. Gary Putup spent about 30 years in law enforcement in a number of different departments, and also helped run the New York CLU, Civil Liberties Union, but it was a big victory for Peter Lawrence in the district northwest of Rochester. In our last conversation with Peter Lawrence, he said, say fact. Peter's back on the line. So, Peter, thanks for getting back on the line with us again. When it comes to your victory, how much do you chalk it up to the SAFE Act?
The SAFE Act was significant, I think, but it wasn't the only issue. There were concerns about the business climate, where our business taxes are arguably the highest in the country. Lack of well-paying jobs, Common Core was certainly a big issue that existed here in this district. There were just many issues that the electorate was concerned about. And fortunately for me, there were issues that I could identify with them, and I got voted in.
Peter, you're going to a minority in the Assembly, but the New York State Senate has turned over to Republican control. And I'm curious now, if you go to Albany thinking that there is any chance to actually repeal or replace any part of the SAFE Act, is that realistic?
Being completely truthful, I don't think it's realistic to say that you can repeal it, because it is obviously a high-profile issue that Governor Cuomo touts. He's very proud of it. So, I mean, to repeal it, you would have to have enough votes to not just pass it in the Senate and the Assembly, but also to override a veto, and I just don't think that's possible. So when you speak about the SAFE Act, I think probably replacing different provisions of the SAFE Act makes more sense.
Okay, and I certainly will see in the new year if there is an appetite for that in Albany. That will be an interesting development to watch. Peter, you also talk about taxes and spending, and last night we heard Rich Funke, who won the state Senate seat over Ted O'Brien, a Republican, Rich Funke, saying that we need a smaller, more efficient state government. But then he said that if Buffalo got their $1 billion, by God, Rochester ought to be next in line. And he's essentially endorsing the notion that the state spending about $1 billion over a number of years in Buffalo has sparked growth successfully. Do you agree with that?
I'm not sure I really understand your question. I'm not sure that the spending up in Buffalo has sparked growth. And I do believe that we need a smaller government. I do believe that we need less government spending. There's a lot of issues out there. There's a lot of places where spending can be cut, and I think that it should.
Will you fight for a Rochester billion, the same kind of investment in Rochester from the state to help grow businesses and jobs that Buffalo has had?
I will certainly fight for Rochester to get its fair share of the money that the government is spending. Absolutely, Evan.
I only ask because I'm trying to sort of get my head around the notion of, do we want smaller government that spends less, and do we think government does not actually create jobs, or do we want the government to spend more?
I kind of think that you're asking me two different things.
I mean,
if the money is going to be spent, am I just going to sit by and watch it go someplace else, or will I fight that our area gets its fair share?
Yep.
That doesn't necessarily mean that I'm in favor of it. But if it's going to be spent, I'm certainly going to fight for it.
I understand. Yeah, I understand the distinction. All right, Peter, last question then for you. Now that this campaign's over, what surprised you the most? This has not been something that you're accustomed to. You've been in law enforcement, then a U.S. Marshal. And having to go out and talk to people door-to-door, face-to-face, what surprised you the most?
Well, first of all, I'll be truthful with you. Going door-to-door, I thought would be cumbersome. But the reception that I got, even from people who weren't necessarily supporting me, the reception that I got from the constituents, from the voters, from the citizens here in the 134th Assembly District was fantastic. I probably knocked on 2,500 to 3,000 doors, and if I had two or three people that weren't personable, hospitable, it was a lot. Everybody took their time. They spoke with me. They said how nice it was that somebody was coming around and knocking on the doors. I really kind of started to look forward to doing that. So it was a little bit difficult, but I enjoyed it. And again, like you said, having been in law enforcement, this was different. I had some pretty good positions with the state police, with the marshal's service. I wasn't used to I'm used to giving orders. I'm used to telling people, making decisions and so forth. But this time, I wasn't doing that. I was going out and I was asking people for something that was very, very valuable to them. And
well,
very fortunate. I'm glad that they had the confidence in me to support me. And I promise them and I promise you I'm going to do everything that I can on the 34th Assembly District.
Again, congratulations, Peter. Thanks for taking the time for us.
Thank you, Evan, yes.
Peter Lawrence, the winner of the 134th Assembly District seat there, a Republican who joins a number of Republican colleagues in a very successful day and night for Republicans here in New York and across the country. All right, short break. We're coming back with David K. Johnston, investigative journalist and Pulitzer Prize winner. We're looking at wage disparity, the minimum wage, and we'll also get a handle on the election results here and across the country. What does that mean for issues like this going forward? His latest material focuses on what the top earners make compared to what the bottom earners make. So, a lot to talk about with David K. Johnston next hour right here on Connections.